Planning to follow the Yellowstone to the far mountains, Clint Connor made his way westward. He opted to avoid most of the infrequent settlements he encountered along the river, riding around the random cluster of tents and shacks of traders and trappers. The occasional farm bore evidence of the Indians' departure as a few brave souls moved in to attempt a living in a land still far from civilized. After camping one night near the confluence of the Yellowstone and the Rosebud Creeks, he rode on until he struck another creek where he came upon two men in the process of building a cabin. Inclined at first to ride around them, he reconsidered, thinking the men looked innocent enough.
Good day to you.
They were so intent upon their labor that both men were startled. After quickly moving to stand next to the rifles propped against the knee-high wall of the cabin, they stared back at the stranger for a long moment before one of them returned the greeting.
Good day to you.
All right, if I approach.
Well, come on.
The men, after scrutinizing him and his pack horse for a few moments, decided that Clint was no more than a lone traveler.
Well, howdy. Where are you heading?
West.
Any place in particular?
Just west.
Well, how are you gonna know when you get there? You new in this part of the country?
Yep. But I reckon everybody out here was new sometime.
The two men looked at each other.
Well, step down, if you will. We're fixing to knock off for some dinner. You're welcome to join us.
Much obliged. I'm getting a little stiff in the saddle, and a cup of coffee would taste good right now. I'll even furnish the coffee.
It turned out that the men were brothers, John and Julian Tate, and they were the vanguard for two younger brothers who were planning to join them in the spring.
We're figuring on setting up a sawmill. James and Jeremy will be bringing the sawmill with them.
Clint gave his name as Clint Allen, using his middle name for last.
Now, we're thinking this is a good spot for a town, what with the steamboats coming up the river and all. If you're just looking for a place to settle down, you might consider right here.
You may be right, but right now I'm just going to see what I can see.
Soon the coffee pot was bubbling, and the Tate brothers fried up some bacon to eat with biscuits they had made that morning. Taking coffee only, Clint spent a pleasant hour with them before climbing back in the saddle.
Good luck with your sawmill in town.
2 days later, in the late afternoon, Julian Tate saw a lone rider aboard a strawberry roan approaching at a slow walk. He straightened and gazed toward the edge of the cottonwoods.
John, there's somebody coming.
John turned to follow his brother's gaze.
I swear, it's getting downright crowded out here. That's the second rider we've seen in 2 days. I wonder if he's as lost as that other fella.
Looks like you fellers have got a right fair start on a cabin.
Deputy Marshal Zach Clayton looked around the clearing, noting the small tent off to the side and the horses hobbled a few dozen yards away. He saw no sign of women or children.
I'd figured on resting my horse and camping close to the creek tonight, but I'll ride on a ways.
What brings you out this way, friend?
I'm looking for somebody. I'm a deputy marshal out of Cheyenne, Wyoming territory.
He opened his coat to display his badge.
Two fellers robbed a bank over at Helena. Pretty bad pair. One big with a flat nose. The other one rangy with a face like a weasel. You seen anybody like that?
Well, Cheyenne? Well, you know you ain't in Wyoming territory, don't you?
I know, but I started chasing them in Wyoming. You seen them?
Both brothers shook their heads.
Nope. Ain't seen nobody like that. We don't get much company.
Except for the last 2 days.
Well, yeah, that's right. You're the second feller passed by here in the last 2 days. We didn't see nobody for a month for that.
Appears like you know where you're going, though. Now, that feller we saw the other day didn't rightly know where he was headed. He was nice enough young feller, though.
Was he riding a buckskin dun?
Well, as a matter of fact, he was. Is he a friend of yours?
Maybe. How long ago did you see him?
Day before yesterday, about dinner time.
Remember his name?
No, I swear I don't. You remember Julian?
Allen something, or something Allen. I ain't sure.
Coincidence was piling upon coincidence. Clayton told himself the stranger they'd seen was not likely Clint Connor. He didn't figure Clint to be traveling west along the Yellowstone. He felt sure the young man would have headed straight for that young lady on the other side of the Tongue River. Still, it was intriguing enough to encourage him to try to pick up his pace in hopes of catching up with the man, just to satisfy his curiosity. He intended to search through every town, trading post, and collection of huts between here and Bozeman on the chance that Ballinger and Yancey might be running this way. If there was no sign of them by the time he reached Bozeman, he would try Butte and maybe Virginia City. He had a feeling they wouldn't fan out too far from the whiskey mills and whorehouses. They had money to spend. He hadn't figured on Clint, though, and he didn't particularly want to catch up with him if he was the man these two men had seen. He couldn't resist, however.
Well, I think I'd best get on my way.
Well, you're welcome to lighten camp here tonight.
Much obliged, but I think I'll push on a ways yet. It's a good hour before dark, and maybe I'll see you fellas on the way back.
3 days without sighting a soul brought Clayton to the thriving settlement of Colson. It had grown a great deal since he had last traveled this part of the country. The recently signed treaties with the Sioux had opened the land along the river to development, and there was already a rush of settlers to claim newly surveyed land for farms outside the town. Clayton was amazed at the new buildings when he rode into the town. A two-story hotel was under construction to add to several saloons, a post office, a general merchandise store, and a telegraph office. Someone had also set up a ferry across the river. It was the kind of place two outlaws like Ballinger and Yancey might find to their liking. Clayton decided to stable his horse and stop over long enough to keep a watch on the saloons and the large tent he spotted near the ferry landing. That was obviously a whorehouse. If Ballinger and Yancey were anywhere in the vicinity, they would most likely show up before long. He could use a little rest. Besides, a day or two out of the saddle and a drink of whiskey would go pretty well. After stabling his horse, he took a walking tour of the town, stopping at the telegraph office first to wire Cheyenne that he was still alive and working. Afterward, he checked the saloons and talked to the bartenders. No one had seen two men matching Ballinger's and Yancey's descriptions. The last saloon he visited was the River House, and this was where he decided to have his drink. There was no one there but the bartender.
These two fellas you're looking for, they friend of yours?
Hardly. Have you seen them?
Well, you a lawman?
That's right.
What'd they do?
Well, lately they robbed a bank up in Helena. Along the way, they've murdered and stole all over Nebraska, Kansas, and Wyoming.
Dang! And you think they're around here?
I don't know if they are or not. I'm just trying to find out. Have you seen anybody that fits that description?
Ain't that something? So we got law in town now. I didn't even know that. How long you been here?
I'm not the local law here. As far as I know, there ain't no law in Colson. I'm a U.S. Deputy Marshal out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, and I'm trying like hell to find two outlaws that might be headed this way.
Cheyenne? Well, that's a hell of a way from here, ain't it?
It ain't far enough.
Yeah? Huh. You know, come to think of it, I think them two fellers might have been in here night before last.
What's your name, mister?
Sam Crowder.
Well, Sam, help me out here, all right?
When Sam nodded, Clayton questioned him extensively about the appearance of the two men he had seen, their behavior, how much money they had spent.
Oh, they was well-heeled, flashing money around all night. They had a good time for theirselves. I kind of hated to see them leave, but they was getting the itch, the big feller especially, to go down by the river to Sophie's. And you think them fellers might be the same ones that robbed a bank in Helena?
Maybe. I can't say for sure till I find them.
Well, I hope you're wrong. Them fellers spent a lot of money in here. I've been looking for them to come back ever since.
Yeah, they're a lovable pair, no doubt about it.
After leaving the bar, Clayton headed over to Sophie's tent.
A lawman? Well, I've done business with more than a few lawmen, but I don't give no discounts to lawmen or lawyers.
I ain't a customer. I'm here on business. I want to ask you a few questions about a couple of your recent customers.
I don't talk about my customers. How long do you think I'd stay in business if I talked about my customers?
Have it your way. I was hoping to save you some hurting. These two I'm looking for have killed a couple of women like you.
Sophie's face suddenly took on a serious look, and she paused to let his comments sink in as she thought about the imposing bulk of Clell Ballinger.
I get paid by the hour. Talk or wrestle, I get paid for my time.
I got no money for prostitutes. I hope for your sake you ain't one of the unlucky ones that has to deal with Clell Ballinger.
Clell? That was a big fellow's name. The other one was Pete. They didn't offer no last names, and I didn't ask for any.
Now we're getting somewhere. Do you know where they went when they left here?
I don't know where they went, but they said they was coming back in a day or two.
Good. I appreciate your help.
Clayton started to leave.
Wait a minute! Ain't you gonna stay around to protect me? I don't want to do no business with a pair of murderers!
Don't worry. I'll be watching for them.
After 2 days of hunting and exploring along Big Porcupine Creek, Clint decided to return to his original plan to follow the Yellowstone west. Impatient now to reach the high mountains he had always longed to see, he pushed on over rolling, tumbling prairie that seemed to stretch endlessly away from the winding river. A day and a half's travel brought him to the confluence with a river he guessed to be the Bighorn, based upon the description he had received from John Tate. The last few mornings had been quite chilly, even though the days were still mild, comfortable in fact. But the cool mornings were fair warning that the mild afternoons would be few in number from now on. Winter was never far away on the high plains, a fact that caused him to seek the protection of the mountains even more, and preferably in time to build a suitable winter camp. With these thoughts in mind, he welcomed the sight of a small trading post on the south shore where the Bighorn joined the Yellowstone. When he first spotted it, he wasn't certain it was in fact a trading post. There was no solid structure, no house or log cabin. Instead, a teepee, painted with tribal symbols, sat before a small corral with a rough shed for a barn. There was a board attached over the entrance to the teepee that proclaimed Jim Cross, trader. It did not show promise of a permanent business. It was enough to engage Clint's curiosity, however. As Clint approached, a strapping bear of a man emerged from the teepee, dressed in buckskins and Indian moccasins. His hair, dark with streaks of silver, was worn long and tied with a single strand of rawhide so that it lay across his back like a great mane. His full beard was solid black except for a streak of white running from each corner of his mouth, giving the appearance of two long fangs. Though demonic at first impression, his face transformed to one of welcome as soon as he smiled and greeted Clint.
Afternoon, friend. My name's Jim Cross. Step down and rest yourself a spell.
Afternoon.
Clint pulled Rowdy up before the teepee. He threw a leg over and stepped down.
If your sign means what it says, I'll be needing a few things.
Well, if I got what you're needing, I will do my best to skin you properly. What is it you're needing? I got some flour and coffee beans, dried beans, salt, if it's food you're wanting.
What I'm looking for is something to keep me warm. Winter's coming on, and I need something more than the wool coat I'm carrying.
Jim Cross nodded his understanding, then stepped back and took a sidelong look at Clint's pack horse and the few mule deer hides tied across his packs. His expression was not one of great expectation.
Well, what do you got to trade? You're thinking about a bearskin coat or something? Them hides there ain't hardly enough to get you a sleeve.
I've got three hides. I need to keep one of them, so I can trade two, but I've got a shotgun, some rifles, and a couple of pistols to trade too.
Well, now, that's different. Sounds to me like you and me can talk some trade. Hold on a minute.
Jim turned his head slightly toward the teepee.
Springflower, come on out here and get a fire going. Make us some coffee.
He turned back to Clint, his smile still in place.
We might as well have us a little something to warm our bellies while we talk.
A slender Indian woman emerged from the teepee.
This here's my woman, Springflower, full-blooded Crow. Come on inside, we'll see what we can do for you.
Clint followed the huge man inside, noticing the rifle propped next to the flap where the woman had evidently stood covering her husband until she was sure that Clint was intent only upon trading. On one side of the lodge, he saw a bed and some cooking utensils. The rest of the teepee was filled with stacks of furs, kegs of molasses, barrels of flour, sugar, beans, and other supplies. Clint was taken aback at the sight of so much merchandise packed inside the small dwelling.
You're gonna need to build you a house.
I know it, and I'm gonna do just that when I make up my mind if I'm gonna stay here or move on to some other place. I ain't sure if this is a good spot or not. Riverboat don't come up this way like it used to. Now, the folks say the railroads will be coming before long, so I might pack up my wares and head farther north. Hell, you're only the second man I've seen this week. Another fellow rode by day before yesterday, and he didn't need nothing.
He reached over and pulled a fur coat from a stack of various furs.
Now, here is the very thing you're looking for.
Cross held out a heavy bearskin coat before him.
Try this on. It'll keep you warm when it gets so cold piss freezes.
While Clint tried the coat on, Cross stood back a step to watch.
That what you're looking for? Springflower stitched that coat. She's got some deer skin shirts and breeches you ought to take a look at, too. Of course, now I need to see what kind of guns you're looking to trade.
Expecting old and worn out weapons, Jim Cross opened his eyes just a touch wider when Clint pulled a Henry rifle out from under the deer skin. He hoped Clint hadn't noticed the sparkle in his eyes when he saw that rifle, but the young man's wry smile told him his reactions had not escaped Clint's notice.
Well, I reckon there ain't no use in beating around the bush on this. This weapon looks to be in fine shape. I just have to shoot it to know for sure.
Clint opened one of the packs and produced a box of .44 cartridges. He took out three and handed them to Cross. Cross loaded them in the magazine and cocked the rifle. Then he walked toward the riverbank and picked a cottonwood on the low bluffs on the other side as a target. An interested observer, Clint watched. He had never fired the rifle himself. It had belonged to one of the men who tried to jump him when he, Joanna, and Carl were camped at the Tongue River. The huge man placed all three shots in a pattern roughly the size of a chair seat. He brought the rifle down and examined it again.
Huh. Pulls a little to the left.
Damn little. I expect that rifle's worth the price of that bear coat and then some.
Maybe. You throw in that box of cartridges.
And you throw in one of those buckskin shirts your wife made.
You got a deal.
At the end of the day, Cross had acquired the Henry rifle with ammunition, a shotgun, two pistols, and a single-shot Springfield rifle. In addition to the bearskin coat, Clint gained a fringed buckskin shirt and pants, and rid himself of the weapons he had no use for. Cross definitely got the better deal, but both men were happy. At Jim's invitation, Clint made his camp there that night. After talking late with the jovial trader, he retired to his blankets, feeling confident that he was now ready to wrestle Old Man Winter in the mountains. He didn't go to sleep right away, however, as he lay there thinking about his plans to find a place to hold up for a while until lawmen gave up looking for him. At the same time, wondering how he would be able to stay away from Joanna for very long. It was during moments like those, alone at night, when he let his confidence slip a little, and he wondered whether there really was any future for him on the path he had chosen. The image of Billy Turnipseed surfaced again in his mind.
What do you say we move on back upriver, Clell? I'm getting pretty damn tired of sleeping outside when I got plenty of money to buy me a hotel room.
Clell Ballinger reached under him to remove a small rock that had begun to bore into his behind.
Maybe you ain't heard, but there's a bunch of folks wearing badges looking for us upriver.
Well, hell, I ain't talking about going back to Helena or Butte, no place like that. Why don't we ride on over to Virginia City? Ain't nobody over that way knows us. Now that's a proper city for two gents like us. They got saloons and hotels and whorehouses that ain't tents. Besides, I expect they gave up looking for us by now.
Ballinger gave it some thought. It did seem pointless to have a bundle of money if you couldn't spend it the way you wanted to.
Maybe you're right. I am getting tired of camping by this river. Hey, let's go to Virginia City. If they do send another marshal after us, we'll take care of him like we did the last one. I'll tell you what, let's go to the river house for a drink and one more round with old Sophie, and we'll start out for Virginia City in the morning. What do you say?
It by God suits me. Maybe I'll last longer than a minute this time.
Deputy Marshal Zach Clayton spent most of the day trying to watch the town as inconspicuously as possible, first from one end of the town and then from the other. He rode out of the quiet settlement after noon and scouted along the river and various creeks in search of a camp. It was all to no avail, and he began to fear that the two outlaws had decided to move on to another town. After cursing his luck for missing the notorious pair yet again, he turned his horse back toward Colson. He was well familiar with the horses the two outlaws rode, and there were none matching their description tied at any of the several hitching posts in town. Walking the dusty street, leading his horse, he checked every saloon, ending up at the river house.
Well, I say you come back to see us. You need a little drink of whiskey?
No. Have you got any coffee?
Yep, I've got a pot on the stove over there. I made it first thing this morning, so it might be a little stout about now.
Hell, that's all right. I like it a little burnt.
Suddenly feeling tired, he took the cup Sam offered and took it over to a table. Ballinger had told the bartender they'd be back. Clinton knew that didn't necessarily guarantee their return, but they might return, so he decided to wait for a while. If they had left the area already, it was going to be another chore to find them, not knowing whether they went east or west. Clint Connor could see a cluster of buildings ahead as he guided Rowdy around a series of gullies that ran to the river. In the distance, he could see the faint outline of a range of mountains. The sight made his heart quicken as he realized that he might reach him in a day or so. He had planned to avoid towns of any size, but Rowdy's left front hoof had somehow managed to loosen the shoe, and Clint wanted to fix it as soon as possible. So in that sense, he guessed it was lucky he came to a town. The stable's owner and blacksmith were one and the same, a cheerful fella named Farley James. He was shoeing a chestnut Morgan when Clint pulled Rowdy up in front of the stable door. Giving Clint no more than a glance, Farley continued nailing a new shoe on the Morgan's hoof until it was finished. Then he dropped the hoof to the ground and straightened up to greet the stranger.
I do. You needing something? Stable or smithy?
Howdy. I think my horse is getting ready to throw a shoe.
Well, let's take a look. Just let me put this horse back in the stall.
He led the chestnut to a wide stall in the rear of the stable and put him in with another horse. He returned and lifted the leg indicated by Clint.
Well, it's loose all right. It's pretty worn, too. If all of them are this worn, it wouldn't hurt to replace them all.
I expect they are. And I expect you might as well replace them.
What about your pack horse? Is he in the same fix?
Well, he's an Indian pony. He ain't wearing no shoes.
All right, then. I'll get right on it. You can stand around and wait, or leave him here and come back in, about an hour.
I reckon I'll wait.
Clint stepped back out of the way. He watched for a while until he became bored with it, and then walked back through the stable toward the corral behind, always interested in horses. Near the back door, he passed the stall Farley had led the Morgan to, He glanced at the horse, just noticing the Palomina in the stall with him. He stopped suddenly.
A Chestnut Morgan and a Palomino. The goddamn world ain't that small.
Taking a closer look, he noted the faces of the two horses. The Palomino with a white race, the Morgan with a white star.
Ballinger and Yancey.
He was struck dumb for a second or two, unable to believe that he had crossed their path again. But he was certain he correctly remembered the horses the notorious pair rode. He quickly walked back to the front of the barn.
Those two horses in the back stall, who do they belong to?
I don't know. Two fellers riding through town.
One of them big with a flat nose, the other one tall and kind of skinny?
I couldn't say. I was gone to dinner when they brought him in. They left him with Edgar. He's the boy that helps me out around here. Edgar didn't say nothing about what they looked like. They gave him a $20 bill and said to shoe him, they'd go get a drink and come back for him. So I shooed him.
Your boy didn't say where the two of them went for a drink, did he?
Nope. I doubt he asked, but the closest saloon is Sam Crowder's place.
Farley pointed toward the south end of the street.
Down the river house.
I'll be back for my horses.
Clint drew his Winchester from the saddle sling.
Maybe I better pay you now. I might be in a hurry when I come back.
Is that right? Maybe you better.
While Clint talked to the smithy, Zach Clayton sat sipping his bitter coffee at a back table in the river house. It wasn't long, however, before his patience ran out on the waiting, as well as the overcooked coffee. He got up and went to the bar where Sam was busy cleaning shot glasses with a rag that looked as if it had been used on the floor first.
Those two men I asked you about, did they give you any idea when they might be back?
Them two? Hell, they was already in here about 30 minutes before you came in.
Why the hell didn't you say so?
We never asked.
Clayton came close to jumping over the damn bar at Crowder.
I've been sitting back there waiting, and all that time you could have told me they'd already been here. I've got a good mind to...
Well, damn, they just went down to Sophie's. Most likely still there, ain't been that long.
Clayton charged out the door. He paused only long enough to draw his rifle from the scabbard. Then he ran toward the river, leaving his horse tied at the rail. When he got to the sawmill, roughly 50 yards upstream from the long tent that served as Sophie's place of business, he ducked inside the shed that housed the steam engine. The mill was standing idle with no one in the engine shed or the long shed where the logs were stacked, awaiting the saw. Making his way around a stack of recently sawn boards, he knelt on one knee while he studied the entrance to Sophie's, taking note of the fact that there was no back entrance. He was not sure the information just gotten from Sam Crowder was, in fact, accurate. He remained there for a quarter of an hour, waiting to see whether anyone came in or out. Finally, when patience began to ebb, he decided to make his move and assume Ballinger and Yancey were both inside. Running in a slight crouch, his rifle ready to fire in an instant at the first sign of a target, he covered the ground between the sawmill and the tent quickly. Pulling up beside the front flap of the tent, he paused a moment to catch his breath. There was no one in the front part of the tent that served as Sophie's parlor. Stepping carefully on the board floor so as not to make a sound, he moved across the tiny room to the curtain that served as a wall between the parlor and the bedroom. Having been there before, Clayton knew that there were only three compartments in the tent. The third was Sophie's kitchen. From the sound of it, he knew that Sophie was in the midst of a business deal.
Damn, Sophie, what the hell's the matter with you? You look like a scared rabbit. If you don't loosen up and give me the ride I paid for, I'll take my money back.
I'm sorry, Clell. I'm doing the best I can.
By God, you was a hell of a lot more worth my money the last time.
There was one question in Clayton's mind now. Where was Pete Yancey? He automatically took a quick look over his shoulder to make sure there was no one behind him.
Clell, you're hurting me!
Clayton decided to move in before the woman was hurt badly. He would have to take the chance that Yancey was not with Ballinger. He thrust the curtain aside and burst into the room and immediately knew he was a dead man. There was no one on the bed. Grinning wickedly at him on the other side of the bed, Ballinger stood in nothing but his underdrawers, one arm around Sophie's neck, holding her before him as a shield. With the other hand, he aimed a pistol at the surprised deputy marshal.
Well, if it ain't my old friend, Deputy Zach Clayton.
Hello, Ballinger. Where's that other cockroach you ride with?
Yancey? Oh, he's around here somewhere. Probably asleep in the kitchen. He always gets sleepy after he's had a tussle with a woman.
Yancey! Come see what I caught sneaking into town.
Knowing the only chance he had was to keep the gloating monster amused, Clayton attempted to jape him.
I gotta admit, that was pretty slick. How the hell did you know I was out there?
Got you dead to rights, didn't I? Sweet old Sophie here needs a thicker curtain. When the sun shines through that open tent flap, it throws a shadow on the curtain. You just happened to come in when I was just fixing to get down to business.
Irritated then that Yancey had failed to respond, Ballinger turned his head toward the kitchen curtain.
God damn it, Yancey, wake the hell up!
Clayton didn't hesitate. He figured it was the only chance he was gonna get. When Ballinger turned to call Yancey, he gave Clayton a target for one shot. Though only half his face was exposed, when he turned back to face the deputy, Clayton fired his rifle. The bullet caught the huge man in the temple. Ballinger dropped to his knees, then fell flat onto his face. Certain Ballinger was dead, Clayton immediately turned his rifle toward the kitchen curtain, expecting shots from Yancey, but there was no sound from that quarter. With no more than a glance at the terrified woman, Clayton edged over toward the curtain, mindful of the surprise he had received when he came from the parlor.
You ain't hurt. Put your clothes on and be still.
With still no sound or motion from the kitchen, he decided it was now or never. So he grabbed one end of the curtain, and with one violent move, he ripped it halfway across. At the same time, he knelt again with his rifle ready, only to confront an empty room. He stood frozen for a few moments, staring at a gaping rip in the outside canvas where Yancey had hastily fashioned a rear exit to Sophie's tent. Dashing over, Clayton peered through the opening Yancey had cut in the back wall, just in time to see the outlaw scurrying over a pile of logs. There was no shot, but he took it anyway, hoping for some luck. The slug ripped a chunk from a log, but Yancey got away. Knowing that he couldn't afford to let him escape to take cover in the town, Clayton plunged through the tear in the tent, faced with the prospect of making it across the 50 yards of open ground without getting shot. Running as fast as he could while trying to zigzag to present a more difficult target, he felt a rifle slug kick up dirt beside his foot. That told him that Yancey took the shot while still running. In a matter of seconds, he reached the cover of the log pile Yancey had escaped behind. He paused to consider his next move. Looking beyond the logs to the saw shed, he could see very little cover available to Yancey. Then, too late to get off a clear shot, he caught a glimpse of the rangy fugitive as he ran toward the general store.
Damn.
There were too damn many places in town that offered Yancey the opportunity to wait an ambush. After hearing the shots from within the river house, Clint and Sam rushed outside to see a man run around the general store and stop at the corner of the building, obviously preparing to ambush someone. Clint felt a cold sensation grip his stomach. The man looked like Pete Yancey, but Clint wasn't certain. But Yancey or not, he was apparently waiting to shoot someone chasing him. Clint cocked his rifle and started toward the store.
Yancey, drop it!
Yancey's reactions were lightning fast, but his aim was high as he whirled around and fired. His bullet went through the crown of Clint's hat, knocking it off his head. Before Yancey could adjust his aim, Clint pulled the trigger. The slug slammed into Yancey's forehead, dead center. The last two shots, right between the store and the saloon, caused the unwise outpouring of people from other buildings, anxious to see what had happened. Clint, his heart still pounding from the near-death encounter, backed away slowly, uncertain of what he should do, if anything. He had just killed a man, but it was certainly good riddance. His uncertainty was short-lived, however, because Zach Clayton suddenly appeared around the corner. There was no choice other than to run. Seeing that Clayton was distracted by the discovery of Yancey's body, Clint turned and hurried toward the stable. He met Farley James as the smithy came running from his barn.
What happened?
Feller got shot. I need my horses.
In the front stalls.
What'd he look like, Sam?
Well, hell, I don't know. I mean, he was a fairly young feller. Clean shaven, about your height, I reckon. Maybe a little more husky.
Did he give his name?
Nah, I never asked him. He was mighty interested in this feller and the other one, though. Asked me all kind of questions about him.
I know his name.
One of the spectators stepped forward.
I own the stables and blacksmith shop. I shoot his horse about an hour ago. His name's Allen. At least that's what he said it was.
Allen, huh? Was it Clint Allen?
Maybe.
You know where he is now?
He took off. Got his horses and left not 30 minutes ago.
Damn.
Clayton had been so close to sewing up the entire affair. Half an hour's start. He was tempted to just forget about Clint Connor, alias Clint Allen. Instead of arresting him, he ought to give him deputy's pay for killing Yancey. The fact was not lost upon him that Clint had probably saved his neck yet again. To further complicate things, he had two bodies to take care of, as well as retrieving what bank money they still had. He had no intention of hauling Ballinger and Yancey all the way back to Cheyenne.
Is there a doctor in town?
Nope.
What about an undertaker?
Well, Elmer Brady here usually takes care of that. He's the barber.
Clayton turned to find the barber at his elbow.
Are you Brady?
Why, yes, sir. I can take care of him for you. You want a plain pine box? For a little more money, I can fancy it up a little.
There's another body down at the horse tent. I don't give a damn if you just dig a hole and throw them in it together. The territorial governor ain't likely to pay for a fancy coffin for the likes of these two.
Clayton turned back to the stable owner.
You got their horses?
I do.
Meet me back at the stable in a few minutes.
Clayton turned again to Elmer Brady.
I need you to write death certificates for the two of them.
Death certificates? Oh, I don't know nothing about writing no death certificates. Around here, if we put them in the ground, folks just assume they're dead.
I need verification that the two of them are dead, since I ain't toting no bodies back with me. It doesn't have to be an official certificate. Just write it out on a piece of paper, date it, and sign it as undertaker.
All right. Oh, no, wait. Sorry, I can't.
Why not?
Well, I don't even know their names.
I'll give you the names.
Oh, all righty then.
After searching both bodies, Clayton picked up the death certificates and went to the stables, where he collected the weapons and saddlebags with the remainder of the money stolen from the bank in Helena. He decided to take Ballinger's Chestnut Morgan to carry the extra baggage, leaving the showy Palomino in Farley's care. With matters taken care of in Colson as well as could be expected, Clayton was at last ready to go after Clint. It would have been easy to let the fugitive go, but Clayton knew that he had to follow him to put an end to the affair.
I don't suppose you got any idea which way he went when he left here.
Well, no. Like I said, I was on my way to see what the shooting was about. But I expect I can find his tracks easy enough.
Without hesitation, Farley walked out to the front of the barn and started staring at the many hoof prints in the dust. Almost immediately, he stopped and straightened up.
There you go. That's him right there.
How the hell do you know those tracks are his?
Easy. I hadn't finished filing down those new shoes before I ran up to the saloon. See that burr on that shoe? And there's another one on that one there? And if that ain't enough, that's the tracks of that Indian pony he's leading that ain't got no shoes.
That ought to be enough, if I can catch up with him before those burrs wear off.
With no real destination, Clint rode north, away from the river, pushing Rowdy hard, knowing that somewhere back there, Clayton would be coming after him. The farther away from the river he rode, the rougher the terrain got as he made his way through treeless expanses of uneven prairie. As he rode, periodically looking back over his shoulder, he questioned his decision to kill Peter Yancey. In truth, he had not planned to shoot Yancey. He had just thought to prevent him from ambushing someone. It might have been better if he had let Yancey shoot Clayton. Now, he was left with three choices: ambush, surrender, or run. Since he had no intention to surrender and no desire to ambush the deputy marshal, he was left with no choice but to run. The immediate problem, however, was his tired horses. As soon as he came upon a small creek, he dismounted. While the horses drank, he climbed up to the top of a low mesa and looked back over the way he had come. There was no sign of anyone on his trail so far. From now on, he decided he'd better take more pains to hide his tracks. The prairie he looked out upon was broken with many low hills and grass-covered ravines like the ones his horses were now grazing in. Since leaving Colson, he had ridden straight north. It might be best if he veered from that course. It was time for another decision. The mountains he had seen in the distance when he arrived in Colson were to the west. His initial intention had been to gain the safety of those mountains and hide out until he felt it safe to return for Joanna. But it seemed that his destiny had been written to cross trails with Zach Clayton no matter where he went. He'd made up his mind that he would not be taken alive by Clayton again to be returned to prison. And the thought of being eventually tracked down and killed in the far mountains without ever seeing Joanna again was not one he could accept. The woman was on his mind almost constantly. His decision was made. He had met only one woman in his life who he knew he truly loved, and his existence seemed empty without her. After the horses were rested, he would turn to the east.
If I'm lucky, I'll lose Clayton. If not, I still have to see Joanna one more time before I have to kill or be killed.
He sat Indian style on the mesa for over an hour, watching the empty prairie. Then he started back down to the horses to head east. Although the tracks were easy to identify, it was not always easy to find them, and a fair amount of time was spent before Clayton detected a consistent trail to the north. It was obvious to the seasoned tracker that the direction taken was not selected with any thought other than running as fast as possible. Once Clint settled on a definite direction, Clayton found it easier to track him, following the most sensible path through the rolling prairie and stopping less often to look for tracks to verify the trail. Looking ahead at a low plateau, he wondered how far Clint would run looking for sanction in that direction. It would be one hell of a long way before reaching terrain that he couldn't track him in. Coming to a creek running through the bottom of a ravine, he stopped to water his horse.
I'll be damned. It looks like he stopped here to rest his horses, too.
Examining the prints, he tried to guess how far ahead Clint might be.
Maybe no more than a few hours.
Following the tracks out of the ravine, he smiled to himself when he saw the trail bend to the east. It was the downfall of many a young man, he thought, remembering other occasions when he had cornered fugitives who could not stay away from their lady loves.
It's a safe bet I won't be needing tracks anymore to know where Clint Connor's heading.
The chase continued for most of a week, crossing Big Porcupine Creek and the Little Porcupine. Clayton traveled long days from first light until dark, but he could not shorten the distance between him and the fugitive. He was determined to run Clint to ground now. He had spent too much time in closing the case, and he was anxious to see it end. Consequently, when day after day ended without sight of the man he trailed, Clayton grew impatient to the point of irritation, resulting in a stronger determination to run him to ground. He knew, however, that the chase was nearing an end when he made his camp for the night with less than a day's ride from Frederick Steiner's farm. He would start out in the morning. He was certain of this trail's end. Clint Connor sat in the saddle watching the house from the wagon track that led along the Yellowstone as darkness fell over Frederick Steiner's farm. Now that he had ridden Rowdy to the point of faltering, he hesitated to ride the final yards. What if Joanna had changed her mind about going with him? Maybe it wasn't right for him to take her. He knew it might break her father's heart to see his daughter ride off with an outlaw, maybe never to see her again. One might argue that if he truly loved Joanna, he would turn now and take his troubles elsewhere. Finally, he told himself that he was going to have to make up his mind, and knowing she was only a few dozen yards away, he couldn't turn from her. Joanna Becker took her apron off and left it on the back of a chair. For the most part, the supper dishes were done, except for the cups that were still being used to finish the last of the coffee. Joanna decided to go out on the porch for a breath of air before finishing the cleanup. Outside, she pulled the door shut behind her and walked to the edge of the porch, where she stood to breathe in the cool night air. Gazing up at a clear, moonless sky, she smiled at the canopy of stars so far away, yet seeming so bright in the crisp fall air. As her eyes became more adjusted to the dark, she let her gaze fall to the path before the house and saw a dark figure on a horse slowly taking form. Immediately alarmed, she started for the door.
Joanna!
She recognized his voice at once. Turning back toward him, her heart threatened to burst from her breast.
Clint! Clint!
In a moment of unbridled joy, she hurried from the porch, her feet barely touching the ground. Reaching him, she flew into his arms. Holding him as if he might disappear as suddenly as he had appeared, she pressed her face against his chest.
Oh, I thought I might never see you again.
I thought I could stay away, but I couldn't. I love you, Joanna. I had to come back.
I prayed you'd come back soon. And if you did, I promised myself I wouldn't let you leave again without me.
She reached up to kiss him. His lips found hers in an embrace of two souls crying out for each other. When at last they parted, he placed his hands on her shoulders, holding her at arm's length.
I shouldn't have come back here, Joanna. Zach Clayton is coming on behind me. I don't know how far back, but I know he'll be coming.
He told her about the killings at Colson.
I can't seem to get that man off my trail. Everywhere I go, he shows up, so he's bound to show up here sooner or later. Clayton's a smart man. He knows I'd have to come see you one more time.
She felt as if her heart was being wrenched from her bosom. She didn't think she could stand to see him leave again without her. But she understood why he would not want to endanger her while he was on the run.
Oh, Clint! Will we ever be together? I mean, maybe it wasn't meant to be.
She stepped back.
You must be hungry. Come inside and I'll fix you something to eat.
No. I don't think that's a good idea. It's best if your folks don't know I'm back.
They'll start to wonder what happened to me if I don't come back.
I know. I'll ride over to that little island by the river and camp there tonight. If you can get away in the morning, meet me out there. But don't tell anybody where you're going.
I'll be there right after I give him breakfast. Aunt Bertha's gone to bed, sick with a headache, so I'll probably be fixing breakfast by myself. Oh, Clint.
They embraced again.
You best go on back inside before somebody comes looking for you.
Oh, good night, my darling. I'll come to our special island as soon as I can. Oh.
The next morning after breakfast, Joanna saddled her horse as fast as she could and galloped down the path by the river. She could feel the joyful flush upon her cheeks caused by the frosty morning air, oblivious of the man leaning against the cottonwood next to the river, or the horse standing below the bank.
Well, good morning, Missy.
Zach Clayton watched the young lady guide her horse along the river trace, waiting until she had created a sizable lead. He then descended the low bank, stepped up in the saddle, and matching Joanna's pace, started after her. Before Clint saw Joanna, Rowdy alerted him that someone was coming. He moved up through the willows until he could see the trail that wound along the bank. With his rifle raised and ready to fire, he waited until the rider appeared. It was Joanna, riding one of his Indian ponies, the little mare that she had adopted for her own. His heart quickened as he lowered his rifle and ran to meet her. She urged her horse into the shallow water, and she crossed over to the little island where he stood, ready to catch her in his arms as she stepped down. Their embrace was long and passionate, and wouldn't have ended so suddenly but for the voice behind him.
I hope I ain't interrupting.
Clint cast Joanna aside and reached for his rifle on the ground, only to confront Clayton, sitting on his horse on the other side of the river, his own rifle trained on him.
Now, see, there you go again. Every time I see you, you're pointing that rifle at me, and I've already got mine aimed right at your gut. Why don't you just lay that weapon back down where it was, and we'll talk.
I can't do it, Clayton. I got railroaded the last time I listened to you, and I ain't going back to that prison. I reckon you're gonna have to shoot me.
No! Clint, he'll kill you!
Better listen to her, Clint. You ain't no killer. Besides, I didn't come here to talk to you. I rode all the way over here to talk to this young lady.
Clayton rode up to Joanna.
Good morning to you, ma'am. I came to bring you some bad news. There were two men shot dead over in Colson last week, both fugitives from the Wyoming Territorial Prison. I got their names right here on a death certificate. Clell Ballinger and Clint Connor. I recollect you had some interest in Connor. I'm sorry to have to bring you the news of his untimely death, but I thought you'd want to know.
He put the papers back inside his coat pocket and slipped his rifle back in the saddle sling.
I guess I'll be going now. Got a long ride back to Cheyenne. You young folks carry on with what you were doing. Good day, Mr. Allen.
Clayton turned his horse. Lawless Prairie is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2009, Charles G. West. Published by arrangement with NAL Signet, a member of Penguin Group, USA Incorporated. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. performed by Mort Shelby, Bradley Smith, Michael John Casey, Thomas Keegan, Alyssa Wilmoth, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Michael Glenn, Stephen Carpenter, David Coyne, Colleen Delaney, James Konachek, Yasmin Toisan, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Christopher Graybill, Nick DePinto, Johann Detweiler, Gregory Gordon, Danny Gavigan, Joel Santner, Patrick Busick, James Lewis, and Nathaniel Perry. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaways, directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan, produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and additional music by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Nathaniel Perry. If you enjoyed Lawless Prairie, be sure to listen to Charles G. West's Duel at Lohawk, Tanner's Law, Luke's Gold, and Shootout in Whiskey Hill, as well as Great American Westerns, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. We appreciate it.
Graphic Audio presents Stephen L. Kent, Rogue Clone.
Look, they're showing the Barefoot Contessa at the theater over there. Maybe we can go see it tomorrow? Do you think Ava's a clone?
You're still not going on about that actress. Who cares if she's a clone? How would I know if she's a clone?
I don't know. I mean, I figured you being a clone and all, you might know.
It's not like that. Most clones don't even know that they're clones. They die if they...
Oh, right. I heard about that. They die if they find out they're clones. Is that for real? I heard about that, but I never believed it. How come you didn't die when you found out?
I'm not a normal clone. I'm a liberator. Liberator clones don't have the death reflex.
Aren't liberators supposed to be dangerous?
I make my living beating the shit out of people in an Iron Man competition. I guess that makes me dangerous.
Did you know that you're a fugitive from the law, Harry? Ever heard of the Elite Conscription Act?
Can't say that I have.
It's brand new. Congress just enacted it. It gives all four branches of the military the right to call men back to active duty, whether they want to go back or not.
Just like that? They pass a new law and poof, I'm recalled. I thought Moreland didn't want me in his corps.
Moreland isn't in charge anymore. He was killed in action on Hummel. The aliens he said didn't exist killed him and his division.
No shit.
You know, the aliens that you saw, the ones that don't exist, they're taking over the galaxy. At least we think it's them. No one else has seen them and lived. No one but you.
Grenadiers forward. Rifles cover the rear. Peterson, out here now. Watch the walls.
What?
They're spiders, dammit. They're crawling up walls.
Oh, shit! They're all around us!
Pull your pistols!
I'll slow the bastards down!
Use grenades. Don't worry about the trip home. Got any rockets left?
It's all I've got left.
Give it here.
I can't...
Shut it, asshole. I'll be right behind. Now, move!
Lieutenant! Those fucking spiders are coming in behind us!
Run! Go! Just go!
Available now in graphic audio. War is blossoming throughout all of Holtz. Slaughter and death spread to every corner of the land. The people cry out for a savior, and Branson Garabond will have to make the ultimate decision. What does he owe? The epic saga continues in R.A. Salvatore's The Dame. Available now in graphic audio. Smoke Jensen's wife is shot. He will carve a bloody path through all of Colorado, leading straight to the heart of the villain. If you think you know violence, you ain't seen nothing yet. Don't miss The Visceral Revenge in The Mountain Man number 39. Assault of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.